History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and then invest a little time to patiently listen as memories from long ago start to rise to the surface once more. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today's program will focus on an 80th anniversary that snuck past with relatively little fanfare last week. In fact, you may not even have heard a mention of it, but I'm talking about the Bataan Death March, when perhaps as many as 80,000 American and Filipino prisoners, most of whom had already been starving, were forced to march more than 60 miles, with thousands dying along the way and thousands more dying later in captivity. Most of those fortunate enough to survive the death march had to wait more than 3 years before they would taste freedom again. After World War II, some of the Japanese officers orchestrating the death march were tried for war crimes and sentenced to death. It is an ugly chapter of history, but one that should never be forgotten. And we've been blessed over the years to meet several men who survived that horrific ordeal. 80th anniversary commemorations were held last week in places like Albuquerque, New Mexico, where Bataan Memorial Park was a place the locals gathered during the war to update each other on the status of loved ones. New Mexico had more men on the death march, nearly 2,000, than any other state. The USS Hornet Museum in Alameda, California is another place where descendants of Death March survivors and descendants of Death March victims gathered this last week to honor their legacy. And, you know, there are a couple nonprofit organizations that work year-round in preserving this specific kind of history. If you head over to hometownheroesradio.com, I have links for you to both the Bataan Legacy Project and the Bataan Corregidor Memorial Foundation of New Mexico. Throughout this episode today, you'll hear memories from men who were there when the Bataan Death March began and were in the Philippines when World War II began for America. We're going to start with Bud Kirchhoff, a native of Illinois who had joined the National Guard in 1936 and had arrived in the Philippines right around Thanksgiving in 1941 with the 192nd Tank Battalion. Pearl Harbor and those installations in Hawaii weren't the only targets struck by the Japanese on December 7th, 1941.
Well, we got bombed the same day. Clark Field was a mess. You know, all the planes were landed and they were sitting ducks.
Sitting ducks, yeah. Destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Then they had dive bombers behind the high-level bombers, and I was only 100 yards from Clark Field when it was bombed. So we were vulnerable, especially in the dive bombers, which were also strafing and things like that. So,
what did that feel like? What went through your mind when you saw these planes coming in and everything's blowing up in front of your eyes?
Well, I don't know that you could say it. You think. You just react. You just do what you have to do. What happened was that right after the bombing took place, not right after, but a few days later, they had a landing party at Lingayen Gulf. That's where the Japanese landed. Our group went up there. I wasn't in that particular action because I was on detached service to the MPs. And so when they finally got back there, then I left the MPs because I didn't need them anymore. And I got back in the tank again. But that was where the actual land fighting started, was Lingayen Gulf. And they moved gradually back to where we all that could get there were in Bataan, and that's where the peninsula of Bataan, and that's where we retreated to. And we defended there for, April 9th we surrendered. So I think 4 months that we were actually in combat mode.
How intense was that? Did you spend most of that inside a tank? Or where
good,
were you?
Good part of it, yeah.
Did that make you feel fairly safe, or did you feel like you were a target?
Actually, they aren't safe. Mm-hmm. they're not safe, but a tank is the first object of their try to destroy, see. So a jungle is no place for tank warfare, let me tell you. So we were kind of hamstrung in the tank warfare and the infantry. So then, well, April 9th, we surrendered, and I got a little story. I was still in my tank when we surrendered.
Uh-huh. Did you know that was coming? Did you have a pretty good idea that this was going to happen?
We knew that we were surrendered. We weren't really, what do you call it? Anyway, we surrendered as a whole entity,
right,
the whole group, which was different than just surrendering as an individual or group, small group. So they had us burn our tanks, to butt plates off the guns, and open the gas tanks. And we had aircraft engine fuel in there, so, it burned in a hurry. Anyway, we all got in this truck, and we were going back to where we were getting together anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody didn't tell the Japanese that we had surrendered. So here come two Zero fighters strafing, and you never saw a truck empty so fast in all your life.
Holy cow.
Yeah, they were straight. I don't know anybody. I didn't get hit. I guess a couple of them got hit. So then I didn't go back to that truck again. I wandered through the woods until I got to our group. So we're sitting alongside the road, and the major in charge of maintenance came along and said, "Hey, you guys want to come with me?" And I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "We're going back to the maintenance department and get some clothing and canteens, and if there's any food, we'll bring it back." So I went with him, another fellow. There were three of us. So there's a beautiful blue Buick, about a 1939 or 1940. So we took all the stuff that we had collected and put it in the trunk and in the back seat. And we're driving back, and I was driving, and all of a sudden a little got out in front of us, and he stopped. And so he said, "Follow me," or didn't say it. He just motioned.
Mm-hmm.
So we wandered over under a huge tree that must have been an 8-foot trunk or 10-foot trunk of the tree, and it was like a house under there. Was heavy branches were 10-15 feet wide on each side. Under this tree is sitting a guy in a beautiful white uniform. It was a general,
a Japanese general.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and so we figured we're dead ducks. We were stealing their stuff because they owned it now that we were surrendered to them. All that guy wanted was the car. And I don't blame him. He's a general. He's entitled to a private vehicle.
Brand new, nice-looking American car.
Oh, yeah, it was. Yeah. So anyway, we figured we were going to get shot for sure. But only when we had to take all this stuff out of this car and carry it back to where we were stationed on the long side of the road. So that was one of those things that was funny, but it could have been deadly. So the worst part about the death march was the debilitating effects of the lack of food for the last 4 months, small amounts of food that we had, and just being in the Philippines. Now, like I say, we were only there for 18 days before the war started, so we weren't even acclimated to the difference between being in Chicago and being in Manila. There had been a directive come down to fight to the end, and this general who surrendered us, General King, said he wasn't going to do that, and so he surrendered us to the Japanese, and that's, of course, when they moved us out of Bataan and into Camp O'Donnell. More men died in the Camp O'Donnell than they did on the march, and the reason for that, by then, their reserves strength had been exhausted to a point where they were too vulnerable to everything, any disease. I got diphtheria, among other things. Diphtheria is a dangerous thing. It's very high, high temperature and stuff like that. So, and I was the last one in the group to get a toxin antitoxin, which is what you fight diphtheria with. See, so
mm-hmm.
It was touch and go there for a while. I went to Japan in 1943. Omuta, which is at Fukuoka area, and we're coal mining.
So you were on the Bataan Death March, then you're in two different camps in the Philippines and three more camps in Japan, and you had entered the service, a strapping young Chicago boy of 200 pounds?
About 210.
210. After the march, how much did you weigh?
Well, at the end of the march, when I had the pneumonia, I was about 100 pounds, a little under 100 pounds. Didn't quite get to the 100 mark. But then by the end of the war, I was up to 128.
What kept you going through all that? Was it the interaction with your fellow prisoners? Was it a faith that grounded you? What kept you focused on someday this is going to be over? Because 3.5 years, that's a lot of days to try to keep hope alive and stay positive.
Well, I didn't have a philosophy, as you know, but I did, but I didn't know it. And I just did one day at a time. Just worried about that day because yesterday was gone and tomorrow ain't here yet. So I had the philosophy, if you want, of taking it one day at a time. And the fellows who didn't, that worried about what's going to happen and think about home and everything, they're the ones that didn't make it, see.
But after all this time, 3.5 years as a prisoner of war, you've survived the march, you've been moved through 5 different prison camps, no end in sight. Finally, there is an end in sight. Talk to me about when you were liberated and when you knew that that was going to happen and what it felt like when you said, I'm a free man again. It's been a while.
Right near the end of the war, we start to get glimmerings that it's happening, see? And we're sitting out in the sun. It was lunchtime. And a B-29, we didn't know what it was. It was a big airplane. It went floating by. Mm-hmm. And what they were doing is taking pictures. So they dropped into our camp a map showing where all the prison camps were on this map. So they knew where they were. Mm-hmm. In fact, we had that one camp I was in, the city that was next to us, blown out of, by the firebombing.
But they spared the camp because they knew where you were.
But they didn't hit the powerhouse, the electric, you know, where they make electricity. Mm-hmm. Because we were right next to it, and they didn't hit the power plant.
That's where you're thankful for good intelligence, huh?
Yeah.
Because there were a lot of people that were on the other side of that equation. Collateral damage because the target was too important.
Yeah. Well, the firebombing in Japan, they keep bringing up the atomic bomb and how bad it was and everything. It was chump change compared to the firebombing. Man, it burned down a whole city mm-hmm. with their firebombs and no warning like they did with the atomic bomb. They say we're going to drop an atomic bomb, get out of the way. There was no warning with the firebombing, and the firebombing is much more deadly than the atomic bomb was.
And thankfully, they missed you guys. Then you find out, August of 1945.
August of 45.
After the second bomb was dropped?
Yeah. And like I say, I was only 40 miles from Nagasaki when they dropped that second bomb. In fact, the camp I was in, actually, I had a very weird experience, or unusual, maybe is a better word. After we were freed, they said, well, they came into camp, said, well, you're now free to go home and leave everything behind you don't need, and stuff like that, because they were dropping food and stuff to us.
But it seemed kind of too good to be true at that point? Like you thought that day would never come?
No, you know what? I thought, well, it's about time. That's all I thought.
Yeah, I guess so.
So we're in this camp, and this one is up in the mountainous area. There were 2 other guys. I said, well, let's go wander around Japan and see if we can find another camp and stuff like that. So we started to go out to camp, and a British major who was in charge of the camp said, hey, where are you guys going? We're leaving. He said, oh, I'm in charge of this camp. You got to stay here. Well, we told them in no uncertain terms that we're leaving anyway. So mm-hmm. I and these 2 other fellows wander around Japan for a whole month. And we'd go from some prison camps. Some nights we'd stay right in town, lay out, sleep around the public square. We got hungry. We'd go to another camp, and they'd have some food. And we spent a whole month wandering around Japan.
I want to hear what it felt like when you got back to the States.
We landed in Seattle. I flew from Okinawa to Clark Field, which we had left a few months ago.
Yeah,
before that.
You had been there when it got bombed by the Japanese December 7th. Okay.
So then we were on a passenger ship from India, and we arrived in Seattle October the 27th of 1945, exactly 4 years to the day that I left from San Francisco. When I got off the ship, I never really got all excited. In fact, they put us in a hospital train and took us to Clinton, Iowa, Schick General Hospital there. And mm-hmm. that's where we did our rehabilitation.
When your family saw you, did they recognize you?
Oh, well, yeah, but because by that time, I hate to say this, but I had gained about 100 pounds by the time I saw
you. Take it away, I'm bringing it right back. There you go. The number one thing that your experience as a POW taught you, what are you most thankful for from that entire experience that maybe has impacted the rest of your life?
Not to raise your expectations too high in life. Be who you are and don't try to be somebody else like too many people do. They try to extend themselves and are disappointed. And they, I just, when I came back, I just got a job, went to work, and never paid much attention to it anymore. I had no flashbacks or things like that. I just, some of the guys did, couldn't, in fact, they couldn't even handle coming back home. Mm-hmm. It never bothered me a bit.
Bud Kirchhoff, survivor of the Bataan Death March and 3.5 years of captivity afterwards during World War II. It's time for our first break, but we'll hear memories from more men who were there when that infamous incident unfolded. This special edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.